thank you for listening to another Hastings NAS podcast. We are so pleased that you have shown interest in listening to this podcast, and we pray that it is edifying and beneficial for you. You can watch us live every Sunday morning on Facebook, facebook.com/HastingsNAS. And if you are so inclined, you can support the ministries of the church by going to hastingsnas.org/give. Hope you enjoy this sermon. Grace and peace.
Ask you to remain standing for the gospel reading, Matthew 24, verses 36 through 44. This is a passage that we maybe have been familiar with, but I want you to listen to these words that Jesus says to his disciples. But about that day and hour, no one knows, neither the angels nor the Son, but only the Father. For as the days of Noah were, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing until the flood came and swept them all away. So too will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then two will be in the field. One will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding meal together. One will be taken and one will be left. Keep awake, therefore, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready. The Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the world. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. Church, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Where are we going? This is the season, right? Tis the season when we hear that a lot, parents, right? Are we there yet? This is a season we hear a lot of it, right? Because we travel. There's a lot of travel. We go to other states. We go see family. With all the travel throughout the holiday season this time of year, we may be here. Are we there yet? Maybe that's not the tone that's always used. And the answer is inevitably, no, not yet. If we were there, we wouldn't still be in the car. Millie now has this thing when she tells her sister when we're home. Well, they'll be in the car seats in the back seat together, and she'll slap the car seat and wake Maddie up. Maddie, we're home. Except we're not home yet. Like, we're on the way there, but we're not there yet. It started at the entrance to the neighborhood. Now it's like a mile or two out of the neighborhood when she tells her we're home. She's telling her sister in proleptic anticipation that we have almost arrived at our destination. How's that for some $5 vocabulary? Proleptic anticipation. Prolepsis is the practice of living into a future reality as if it were already here. So when you get pulled over by the cops, you say, ah, we're done. In present tense, as if it's already happened when, you know, it's not yet been realized. Maddie, we're home. When we're still a mile out from the house is prolepsis. It's anticipation, and it's her 2.5-year-old, are we there yet? And maybe this is silly, but I think that are we there yet is a hopeful statement. And I mean that truly. It's a hopeful, hope-filled statement. The question, are we there yet, is a hope-filled question, even when it's asked like this, ugh, are we there yet? Maybe that's maybe more of a lament. But I think that lament and birth are and hope are birthed from the same place. Hope and lament come from the same place. They originate from the same place, saying, are we there yet? Is a lament to move on from your current circumstances, from your current discomfort, right? I'm tired of sitting in the car, Mom. But then also saying, are we there yet? It's hope that you are looking forward to what's coming. You're anticipating a forthcoming future, a circumstance that you're looking forward to. Are we there yet? Is hope. It's hope. And I think it's hope because it avoids two things. Hope avoids two things. Are we there yet is hope because it avoids, number one, despair. Despair is the belief that there is no destination that you're going to reach. My teenage brothers and I felt despair on our family vacation when my parents were driving all over Columbine, Colorado, looking for that historic high school before we had a GPS and before we had our smartphones and they didn't have a map. So we were driving around for hours, realizing we're never going to make it. Are we there yet? Turn to, oh, come on, what are we doing? Dad, despair. There's no destination. We're not going to make it. Despair is the first hope killer. But the second thing that avoids hope is presumption. Presumption. And this, I think, we can miss. I think this gets missed. This might be the silent killer of hope, to presume. You see, to presume is to believe that you've made it to your destination while you're still stuck in the car. That's what presumption is. German theologian Josef Pieper says that presumption is a fraudulent imitation of hope. It's a fraudulent imitation. It looks like hope. It sounds like hope. But it just is an imitation of it. You see, if my brothers and I as teenagers were despairing at our lack of destination while driving around aimlessly in Columbine, Colorado, presumption was the posture my parents took when, after driving up to some random elementary school that we all knew was not the school they were looking for, and they drove up to it and said, oh, wow, this is it. I can't believe this is where it happened. They said that to placate their despairing teenage children so that we can move on to the next destination. It was an imitation. It was fraudulent. It's my parents presuming we were at the right location so that their children wouldn't suffer any longer in a hot van, getting car sickness from the turning. Presumption imitates hope, but it does so falsely. It says, we're there, when we're not actually there. Are we there yet? It's hope because it looks forward to what is coming. It knows that there's a destination. It knows that there is somewhere where we will arrive. It does not despair. There is a future. But it also doesn't pretend that where you are is the final destination. It doesn't pretend that where you are is where you will be. It doesn't presume. It looks forward in anticipation. And today, church, is the first Sunday in Advent. It's the first Sunday of Advent, and maybe you've gathered this. The emphasis today is hope. We lit the candle of hope. And I believe we read texts that are hope-filled texts. And this first Sunday of Advent is the first day of the church year, so happy New Year. I don't know if you were ready. You didn't bring your fireworks. You didn't bring your hats and your little glasses that have all the numbers on them. But it's a new year today. We celebrate a new year, and we begin the new year with hope. Hope, not despair, not hope, not presumption. In the text we read today are passages of hope. We read from Isaiah 2 and Matthew 24, and these are both texts that are hope-filled texts. These verses anticipate the future that God has in store for God's people. And Isaiah 2 speaks directly against the hope killer of presumption, the silent killer, that fraudulent imitation of hope. The prophet writes, "In days to come, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the highest of mountains." In days to come. You see, the prophet Isaiah knows that this is not God's ultimate future. The prophet Isaiah knows that what his listeners are experiencing is not the fulfillment of God's intended, impending, forthcoming reality. The prophet Isaiah does not presume to say, hey, look at how good life is for us. We've made it. In days to come, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established. It is still on its way. It is still in the days to come. There are some who make the argument today that in Jesus, God's kingdom has fully arrived. And we would affirm that the kingdom did arrive with Christ as the fullness of God's revelation, but yet we are still awaiting the final consummation. We are still a people who look forward. Church, we have not yet arrived. Now, truth be told, the world in which we live in might be the most comfortable existence humanity has ever known. I mean, really, think about it. We have air conditioning. We've got heat in our homes. We've got tap water. How many of you went to the well to get water for the day today? Right? We have a pretty comfortable existence, more comfortable than humanity has ever known. The world in which we dwell right now might have the most resources ever available to alleviate poverty and hunger. The number one killer of Americans is not hunger or dysentery. It's heart disease. Why? Because we eat too much. Not because we eat too little. We have the tools and resources to mitigate hunger like never before in human history. But I'm telling you, church, this isn't it. The arrival is still to come. Despite our comfortabilities, despite our conveniences, despite how good we have it, I'm here to tell you, let's not presume that this is the fullness of the kingdom of God, because as the prophet Isaiah testifies, the mountain of the Lord's house is still in the days to come. And I hope that's good news. But the prophet Isaiah also avoids the temptation to despair. You see, the listeners of the prophet Isaiah, they were a people who knew difficulty. They were a people who knew the ravages of war. They were a people who knew exile. They were a people who knew what it meant to have your home razed to the ground, to be captured to a foreign land. And to a people who knew exile and captivity, he wrote these words. He wrote, "He shall judge between the nations. He shall arbitrate for many peoples, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares. They will beat their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. The ways of war will not be learned. Items used to take other people's lives will be used to till the soil. Swords will turn into plowshares, spears into pruning hooks, tanks into tractors, guns into gardening tools. The chaos and calamity that you now experience is not going to be forever. It's not going to be the way that it always is. It is not the end. Do not despair." Isaiah tells the people who are prone to despair that this is not how it will be. War will not be learned forever. The prophet Isaiah encourages hope. Hope against despair and hope against the false image of presumption. But then as we look forward to Matthew 24, the second text for our first Sunday of Advent, this is also a passage of hope. Only my hunch is that maybe the ways in which we've read Matthew 24 hasn't always led us to presume that the kingdom of God has arrived. Maybe presumption isn't what we maybe get from Matthew 24. No, my hunch is that these verses have been, for certain folks of a certain tribe, unnecessarily associated with despair. I think the ways in which we've read Matthew 24 can be prone to despair. Not hope-filled, but sometimes despair-inducing. Let me elaborate on that a little bit. Because among certain Christians, Matthew 24 has been read as a warning against what? Two will be in the field. One will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding meal together. One will be taken and one will be left. And a particular reading of this passage says, you don't want to get left behind. Maybe some of you remember the song. There's no time to change your mind. The sun has come and you've been left behind. Woo! That's kind of scary. These verses have been associated with a, bear with me for a moment, church, with a problematic and anxiety-inducing thought that you might get left behind. Are we going to make it? Not are we there yet, but is there a future for me? Any child who's gotten lost in a department store knows the anxiety of being left behind. Unless they're rather mischievous and did it on their own. But what if I told you that these verses are not anxiety-inducing and that these verses of Matthew 24 ought not to cause despair? What if I told you that these verses are actually filled with hope? Matthew 24 is an incredibly hope-filled passage. The text says that when the Son of Man comes, it will be as in the days of Noah. Tell me, church, in the story of Noah, who was taken from the earth? It will be as in the days of Noah. In the story of Noah, who were those who were taken from the earth? The righteous or the unrighteous? And in the story of Noah, who were those who were left behind on the earth? The righteous or the unrighteous? Who was left behind? It was Noah and his family who were left. And those who were taken from the earth in the days of Noah were the unrighteous. They were washed away in the flood. Church, the scriptural promise from day one, from Genesis 1 to the end of Revelation, the promise of the scriptures is this: the righteous will inherit the earth. The righteous will inherit the earth. And sometimes we've read Matthew 24 backwards. Like, completely. The way that Jesus frames his argument, believe it or not, church, he says, in the days of Noah is how it will be when the Son of Man comes. Two will be working, one will be taken, the other will be left. Two women will be grinding meal together, one will be taken and one will be left. Who was left in the days of Noah? Who do you want to be in this story? You want to be left. You don't want to be taken. The text, the logic of the text itself says you want to be left like it was in the days of Noah, because the righteous will inherit the earth. You see, Matthew 24 is a passage not of despair that, hey, you could get left behind and then have to deal with a world that is chaotic and tumultuous. No, it is the text of promise that says, hey, the righteous will be left behind to inherit the kingdom of God. Isn't that a better story? It's not a passage about destruction and chaos. It's a passage about the anticipation of the arrival of a loved one. Just this last weekend over Thanksgiving, my parents came up to us for Thanksgiving. My parents affectionately named Amma and Papa to my daughter were on their way to our house on Wednesday before Thanksgiving. And my daughter kept running to the front window, staring out the window. Amma and Papa here? Amma and Papa here? No, they're not here yet. And she would run to her mother. Mommy, I'm a papa not here yet. You also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour. What if, church, the anticipation of the arrival of the Son of Man is less like the doom and gloom that we've heard so much, but it's like a granddaughter looking forward to the arrival of her grandparents? This message is not despair, but it's hope. The message of the gospel is not punitive and damning as if to say, you better not miss it or else. This kind of fear-oriented thought. No, it says, this text says, hey, this is so good. When the Son of Man comes, it's going to be so stinking good. It's going to be way better than when Amma and Papa show up. It's going to be so good. You don't want to miss out on this. You don't want to miss out because it's going to be great. It's coming. I promise you. It's coming. The arrival of the Son of Man is a day of hope. It is a day of anticipation. I don't know about you, but when I look around at the world, I see a whole lot of despair. I see a whole lot of despair right now. And I see a little bit of presumption as well. So I got to say, I feel like there could be a little bit more hope, especially from within the church. When it comes to presuming, just this week I had a conversation with a good friend about a difficult and potentially divisive topic. I love this friend deeply, and I look up to him in more ways than I could count. He is one of my best friends. And we always have good conversations, and this conversation was about race relations in America. It's a difficult topic, and it's ever present. And I love this man, and I do not disparage him, but I was a bit troubled by his thought that because slavery had ended, and that because redlining was no longer legal, and that because Jim Crow laws had been overturned, that we've somehow arrived. Somehow to say that the work is done and that we should just stop talking about race at all because those things are gone. From my perspective, that felt presumptuous. That is to say that we've made it. We're there. The work is done. It says that there's nothing else to be done, that the work is complete. But church, I don't believe that's hope. I don't believe presumption is hope. To say we've made it does not leave room for anything more. And I think there are times when we think the same way, not maybe about race relations, but about the work of the church. I think sometimes we think we've made it, that the work is done. Maybe not. Maybe we wouldn't say that. Maybe it's more of a practical presumption. Maybe it's more of a lived presumption, an experienced presumption. We might not say explicitly, hey, we've made it, we've arrived at our destination. But maybe the way that we interact with our communities and the ways that we live our lives tell the world around us that we think we have. Hey, look, we got to figure it out. We got it made. I've got the answer for you. Well, maybe people want to wrestle a little bit. If we really believed that Christ was going to come back to bring his good and beautiful community with him, don't you think we'd want to make sure that nobody missed out on it? It's not about fire insurance. It's about an invitation to the party. It's not about avoiding something potentially punitive. It's about participating in something beautiful. And church, I'm telling you right now, this right here is beautiful. We are a small group of ordinary people who live in rural Michigan. And our gathering is a beautiful thing. For it is a microcosm of the kingdom. This is the party. If you flip it, however, I see maybe more, I think it's probably fair to say more, despair. You flip it around and maybe there's more prevalence of, is this it? Is this it? Is this all that there is out there? There's so many who are now despairing that feel like they have no future for them, who feel like they have no opportunity, who feel like they have no destination. I think this is evident in the suicide rates of our teens. I mean, these are our teenagers. Why are our kids killing themselves? These are the ones who have a future, right? These are the ones who have a bright world in front of them, don't they? Ought they not believe that? These are those who feel like there's nothing for them And hear me, church, I don't say this to condemn those who despair to the point of feeling like they need to take their own life. This is not condemnation or shame upon them. This is a lament that hope has not been presented to them. Why do we lose so many more veterans to their own hands rather than to our enemies? Why do our veterans die at their own hands more than at the hands of those who they are trying to protect us from? There's despair. This belief that there's nothing else for me. Ultimate despair. And church, I think we have an obligation. No, I think we have an opportunity. We have an opportunity to communicate to a despairing world that their brokenness that they've experienced, that isn't the end. That is not all that's out there for them. We have an opportunity to communicate to a despairing world that their shame is not all that there is. I think we need to do that. I don't know if you heard about the Walmart shooting in Virginia. There's no excuse for that action. But I was at a store this week, and the dude checking me out, like, of the register, not looking at me, he told me that his cousin worked at that Walmart until 3 days prior to the shooting. And he said that his cousin said to his team, you guys need to be more aware of how you're talking to him. They were giving him so much grief, bullying him nonstop. And his cousin said, you guys need to be more intentional with him because you never know. You never know what people are experiencing. You never know what they're going through. And not treating him with dignity and respect could end up badly for you. Now, there's no excuse for brandishing a firearm and taking the lives of other people. But that person had not been shown hope and dignity. He had been told there is no future for him. We have an opportunity. We have an opportunity to communicate to a despairing world that their shame and their brokenness is not all there is. And church, I want to tell you, the shame and the brokenness that you experience is not all there is. I promise you. We know this because Christ came and because he's coming again. You see, we are called to be a people of hope. Not a people who look at the world around us with despair and say, well, that's all she wrote. There's nothing else for me. Nor are we to be a people who look at the world around us with presumption and say, this is it, guys, we've made it. No, church, hope. Hope, which is a difficult and deep Christian virtue. I'm going to close right now. Do you know what our hope is? Our hope is not a better job. Our hope is not a new car. Our hope is not the newest version of our phones. What is our hope? Our hope is not a thing or a circumstance. Our hope is a person. Our hope is the person that is our King Jesus the Christ. That is our hope. And he is our hope. Why? Because he came. And why? Because he's coming again. And why? Because he comes to us now. We are a people of hope. Because we are a people who say, are we there yet? Or maybe more theologically appropriate, we would say, is he here yet? Is he here yet? Is he on his way? Is he coming? And church, I promise you, he is on his way. He arrives now and he will arrive tomorrow. To hope is not to be given over to despair that God's fulfillment is not going to come. And to hope is neither a presumption that we have already made it, that this is the kingdom now. No, hope says, are we there yet? Church, are we there yet? This is the good news of Jesus Christ for us today.